From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Trump's first week in the Oval Office, rupture with Mexico, immigration crackdown, pipelines, TPP alternative facts, and more. At the Republican retreat in Philadelphia yesterday, the new president said he's assembled an all-star team to lead the country.
We have so many different people that we are putting in office. I think it's the group of all-stars like really nobody has seen before, right? Where is Pompeo? Where the hell is he? Did he ever come here? Oh, he's working?
Truth, lies, falsehoods, all in the headlines. NBC's Chuck Todd challenged Kellyanne Conway, counselor to President Trump, on her use of the term alternative facts.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts?
And huge rallies in the streets in Washington and beyond on Saturday for the Women's March to protest the inauguration of Donald Trump. This was Washington, D.C.
We are the majority vote! We are the majority vote!
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eliana Johnson, Olivier Knox, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. 1 week in, what do you see? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Eliana Johnson, national politics reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Also joining us from Washington is Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Olivier, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Eliana, and Olivia.
We could dive in so many places here, but let's just start with Mexico. The Mexican president said he's not coming. Donald Trump was at the GOP retreat yesterday in Philadelphia, said that he and President Enrique Peña Nieto would not meet next week after all.
The president of Mexico and myself have agreed to cancel our planned meeting scheduled for next week. Unless Mexico is going to treat the United States fairly, with respect, such a meeting would be fruitless, and I want to go a different route. We have no choice.
A different route. Eliana Johnson, what route are we now on with Mexico? Talk about a rupture. He was supposed to come. Trump repeatedly said Mexico would pay for the wall. The Mexican president appeared to be open to negotiation, but that the hammering on that point was more, ultimately, I guess, than he could take. He's not coming. What does this mean for this relationship, Eliana?
You know, Tom, I think there are two things that are astonishing about this. The first, and this really got buried in the news, is that the Mexican foreign minister was meeting with White House officials to plot the details of the Mexican president's visit when President Trump tweeted that the Mexicans would pay for the wall and went to the Department of Homeland Security and delivered a speech about that. The Mexicans took this as an intentional slight, and that resulted in the canceled visit. Now, either it was an intentional slight or it was a result of disorganization and a general chaos in the White House where they didn't coordinate the president's visit to the Department of Homeland Security and the Mexican foreign minister's visit to plan the Mexican president's visit. And it resulted in the Mexicans taking offense, which is troubling and amazing. And the second thing is...
It's troubling and amazing that they took offense?
No, I think that there was either it was an intentional slight or that there was a level of chaos and disorganization in the White House that led to the Mexicans being offended. I think that's quite troubling. Mm. And the second thing is, Trump is saying that the Mexicans are going to pay for this wall, and his press secretary came out and said yesterday that one potential means of that would be a 20% import tax on Mexican goods, which is actually a tax on American consumers. So I think that's misleading. We learned that there really is no real way for him to get Mexicans to pay for this wall. But I think the aspect of how this is impacting America's relations with really after Canada, one of our closest allies, in the hemisphere, is troubling for the way that we're going to conduct foreign affairs in the Trump era.
I mean, Olivia Knox, Donald Trump said he was going to build a wall. He announced that. He said Mexico would pay for it on the campaign trail. He simply went at that yet again now as president. But the tools that were brought out after the cancellation of this meeting, and it's interesting because in the clip we played there, you know, he's talking about that they canceled it. But really, I think it was the Mexican president who said, no, I'm not coming under this. The first firing back from the White House that we heard, really, on Air Force One yesterday, Press Secretary Sean Spicer went right to this 20% tax on imports from Mexico. Let's listen.
If you tax that 50%, $50 billion at 20% of imports, which is, by the way, a practice that 160 other countries do. Right now, our country's policy is to tax exports and let imports flow freely in, which is ridiculous. But by doing it that way, we can do $10 billion a year and easily pay for the wall.
Easily pay for the wall, Olivia Knox. But the first thing, and this has been walked back a bit. I don't know where it's going to end up. But the first instinct is to go right for that gigantic tariff, Olivia.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear whether it was a tariff or something else.
What do you call 20% on goods coming across a border?
It depends. If it's part of a much broader package called a border adjustment tax, then you call it a border adjustment tax. The problem with what Sean Spicer said, well, there are a lot of problems with what Sean Spicer said on Air Force One. The first is that he did characterize it as a tariff. The second is that Mexican imports to the United States are not $50 billion. The trade deficit is roughly $58 billion. So there was a question about whether he was talking about a border adjustment tax to try to bring down the trade deficit or a tariff on Mexican goods, which would be a tax on Americans. The main theme here is disorganization. They weren't just – the Mexicans weren't just offended. The biggest problem here, they had agreed to have this meeting even though the Mexican president is not popular at home. And basically Donald Trump coming out and saying, you know, before this meeting, well, they're going to pay for it. We're going to build this wall. They're going to pay for it. If Enrique Peña Nieto had come to the United States, we would have been able to test whether it's possible for a president's approval rating to be inside the margin of error of a poll. So there were questions of politics here, too, as well, you know, on the Mexican side. On the U.S. side, the White House then walked it back in one of the worst possible ways, saying basically, well, hold on. This wasn't a proposal. We weren't rolling anything out. It's hard to imagine a more formal way to roll something out than have the press secretary describing it on the record on Air Force One to reporters.
It sure sounded like a proposal. But Jack Beatty, disorganized, is that really fair? I mean, maybe. But in the span of 1 week, we have a lot of things happening, a lot of things that Donald Trump promised on the campaign trail and President Trump now acting on. I mean, you know, just right across the board, TPP out, pipelines. Keystone and Dakota Access back on the table, expediting infrastructure projects, you know, the thing against abortion that Republicans always do, but he's doing it. I mean, right on down the line on TPP, done on, at least for now, Obamacare, he's acted on that front. I mean, I guess you could call this disorganization, but to a casual observer, this might look like a lot of things happening and happening quickly, Jack.
Yes, and happening, you could argue, responsibly. These are the things he ran on. He's now doing them. Of course, we haven't heard the responses from them. For example, TPP. The Prime Minister of Singapore told John McCain last year, if you back out of TPP, you're finished in Asia. A study for the Obama State Department found that if China and Japan work out a trade agreement could possibly for them replace TPP, China hadn't been in that, but for Japan, that could cost millions of American jobs. So we haven't heard about the responses. We have had the activity. And, you know, this business with Mexico, this just seems to be an element in it of pique. The president seemed to have been offended by the Mexicans' repeated statement that they would not pay for the wall. And that official who came up, that foreign minister, he just wasn't any personage. He was the fellow who arranged the very helpful visit that Trump paid to Mexico City in August, which helped him in his campaign, which gave him foreign policy credentials. He was the friendliest person to Trump in the Mexican government, and Trump offended him, blew him off, and in effect applied what the Washington Post called dynamite to the U.S.-Mexico relationship.
Eliana Johnson, do you see disorganization here or an administration that's only 1 week in and delivering on many fronts on its campaign promises?
I think with regard to what happened with the Mexican president's visit. We don't know whether the cancellation was a result of disorganization. Certainly, it was the Mexican president who took the initiative to cancel the visit, and then Trump pushed back and said, no, it was he who took the initiative. We don't know whether that was a result of a disorganized White House or not. I certainly think with the executive orders we're seeing on immigration and other things, Trump is signaling what the priorities of his presidency are going to be and that he intends to follow through on many of the things that he campaigned on. Obviously, the reach of executive orders is somewhat limited. Presidents are most powerful when they act with Congress and when they act with Congress in a bipartisan fashion. But that's why I think these are best understood as signals from the president as what the priorities about what the priorities of his presidency are going to be, limiting illegal immigration and perhaps legal immigration as one important thing. But I do think he's sending a signal to his supporters that he intends to follow through on his campaign promises and swiftly.
Olivier Knox, just judging from the horizon that President Trump has touched in this first week, how big the change in store for this country for federal policy?
Well, it's going to depend on how the president and the Congress and the agencies follow up on these executive actions. You know, quick reality check here. The United States wasn't in TPP. He didn't withdraw the United States from anything. He just formally declared what everyone knew to be the case, that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was dead. On building the wall, the White House characterized this as, you know, starting the process of building the wall. There's no money attached. The executive orders don't come with cash. So,
but Congress is saying
brick.
We'll do it. We'll pay for it, as far as
I can
see.
And this is what I mean when I say we're going to have to see how the presidency and the Congress follow up on these things. A lot of these executive actions, they weren't all orders. It's really important to look at the fine print.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, and not just any week. The Trump presidency begins. Moves on immigration, Mexico, TPP, pipelines, Obamacare, abortion, alternative facts. We're looking at Trump's war, he calls it, running war with the media. Eliana Johnson is here, national political reporter for Politico. Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News, and Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What do you make of the first week of President Trump? How about the way he's delivering? Is it the right tone? And what's up with President Trump's problems with truth, facts, if you see them that way? Is he going the right way on Mexico, on provoking? Is he provoking an unnecessary crisis? Does he have it right on immigration? Are we better off without TPP? Here he was with Republicans in Philadelphia yesterday on the wall. It will go up, he said.
Most illegal immigration is coming from our southern border. I've said many times that the American people will not pay for the wall. And I've made that clear to the government of Mexico.
And a broad crackdown on illegal immigration, including, he said, a crackdown on sanctuary cities this week. And he got some immediate reaction there. Miami Mayor Carlos Jimenez signed a memorandum reversing Miami-Dade County's status as a sanctuary for immigrants. Donald Trump praised the decision on Twitter and called it strong. Here, the Miami mayor explained the change to CBS Miami.
We wouldn't hold them unless they guaranteed that we would get reimbursed. Now, today, my order says, don't worry about the guarantee. If the federal government wants us to hold an individual, immigration, you know, illegal immigrant, et cetera, we will hold them for the federal government.
Miami changing, kind of folding their other cities. That's not so clear what they're going to do. Eliana Johnson, when it comes to what's been called a clampdown or crackdown on immigrants, undocumented workers, and immigrants in this country, how sweeping, how wide, how deep, what we've seen in this first week?
The fine print of a lot of these executive orders is yet to be determined. One example is what the definition of a wall is. You know, if you look at the fine print there, it's, you know, contiguous division between the U.S. and Mexico. There are places where you can't build a wall. That's one example. And the question you asked, Tom, gets to another aspect of where it's a little bit murky. How exactly will the federal government clamp down on so-called sanctuary cities? We don't know yet.
I mean, they say they'll cut off federal funds, federal grants, right? Isn't that the threat?
Yep, but we don't know what actions by these cities will trigger the cutoff. So what is it that cities will do that will cause the federal government to trigger that? How will the enforcement work? That's all yet to be determined.
Olivier Knox, we're talking about further buildup in the Border Patrol, a lot more ICE agents around the country. For the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants in this country, does that mean the sweep up that Trump talked about at some points on the campaign, or does it mean, I mean, President Obama was pretty aggressive at some points in deporting the criminal element here. Is there a big change embedded in this week's actions?
Yeah, Latino activists used to call President Obama the deporter in chief. He deported more people than his predecessors by a wide margin. I think there's a danger in sort of predicting based on the first week with certainty whether this means that Donald Trump is following through on his campaign promises. Sean Spicer took a question at his briefing this week from a friendly news outlet, and their question boiled down to why hasn't he kept his promise to roll back the DACA program? It's not really clear yet. As Eliana alluded, it's not really clear what exactly will trigger a possible reduction in federal funding. I've talked to a couple of city halls that say that you'd have to actually rewrite the law on federal funds flowing to American cities in order to be able to choke off the aid. It's not clear. As that mayor alluded to, one of the big problems for cities is, okay, where do we put these people?
If you want us to hold them for you, which some cities have refused to do, but if you want us to, are you going to pay for it?
Sure. And one person I talked to, one person in a major city organization said, you know, New York's experience hosting Donald Trump, running up massive overtime bills for the police.
Trump Tower and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. At one point being estimated at $1 million a day, you know, that was pretty instructive for a lot of cities because that kind of stuff puts a real strain on city budgets. The Miami mayor alluded to the strain on city budgets. So, again, I can't tell you with any certainty what's going to happen on this score under Donald Trump's administration.
Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York, saying they're not going to be helping in deporting what he called law-abiding New Yorkers.
We will not deport law-abiding New Yorkers. We will not tear families apart. We will not leave children without their parents. We will not take breadwinners away from families who have no one else. And we're not going to undermine the hard-won trust has developed between our police and our communities.
And many other sanctuary cities have taken that position in the past. Now they've got a threat against them. Jack Vitti, he says law-abiding New Yorkers, the Trump administration might say, well, if they're here illegally, they're not law-abiding.
Yes, but then the police in New York would say, if you, and this is a familiar argument, if you do this, if you crack down, if we're obliged to, look at their papers, they won't cooperate in solving crime, which is the bigger issue here. I mean, to enforce a civil offense coming here illegally or to try to be effective against violent crime. And I think that argument is won by the police departments in the 39 cities. 364 counties, I see, that have some form of sanctuary city.
Speaking of cities, there was this, I don't know if you call it a threat or the possibility of federal intervention that Donald Trump raised a couple of times this week, Eliana Johnson, about Chicago, where, of course, yes, the murder rate has been at historic highs. Here's just one example. He was talking with the Republicans at the retreat in Philadelphia yesterday, and, it's what's going on, what's going on?
And then you look at Chicago. What's going on in Chicago? I said the other day, what the hell is going on?
Democrats.
A lot of truth to them.
Democrats, somebody said in that crowd. But Eliana, what did Donald Trump raise here? Did it mean federal intervention of some kind? Federal forces on the streets? What?
Yeah, I think it's a stretch to assume that his off-the-cuff comments to Republicans, he's tweeted several times about Chicago, to extrapolate from that there's going to be federal intervention in the city of Chicago.
Okay.
I think he's, as you've seen him do with many other people and things on Twitter, he likes to bait his opponents, be they in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, into wars of words. But I don't think in this case it's fair. One can assume that there would be a link to any sort of policy federal policy in this case.
We'll see. But interesting to have it raised. Baiting, I don't know if this was baiting or not. Donald Trump talked a lot about waterboarding on the campaign trail, and it came up again this week talking with David Muir on ABC News. Said he was talking with his generals on whether or not he'd bring back torture tactics like waterboarding. Here he was.
When ISIS is doing things that nobody has ever heard of since medieval times, would I feel strongly about waterboarding? As far as I'm concerned, we have to fight fire with fire.
Well, that got a pretty fast response from Republican leaders. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the retreat in Philadelphia were asked about President Trump's stance on torture tactics.
Well, I think the director of the CIA has made it clear he's going to follow the law. And I believe virtually all of my members are comfortable with the state of the law on that issue now.
And torture is illegal. And torture's not legal. So, and we agree with it not being legal.
Torture's not legal, Paul Ryan saying there. And you heard Mitch McConnell as well. Lillian Knox, okay, on this front, is this just a, what is this? Is it baiting? Is it a provocation? Is there a real policy standoff already on the way interrogations will proceed in the hands of U.S. forces?
Well, you raised some interesting points with that clip there. So what we also learned is that there's a draft presidential order that would command a review of interrogation practices and possibly the reopening of what are called black sites, secret prisons where the Central Intelligence Agency, secret prisons overseas, where the CIA, after 9/11, held, questioned, interrogated, and in some cases killed detainees. This raised an outcry, a bipartisan outcry in Congress, led by John McCain, the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and somebody who was tortured extensively after being shot down over Vietnam, saying absolutely not. You know, the law is very clear. They can't use anything that isn't in the Army field manual. That's been codified multiple times in law. So there would be a huge pushback from Congress. General James Mattis, now the defense secretary, has told Donald Trump that torture doesn't work and that he gets farther with a couple of cigarettes, a pack of cigarettes and a couple of beers, I think was the was the version he gave. Again, this is one thing where they're clearly trying to sound out the public and the political class about fairly radical changes to the way America does business. But whether he's actually going to push forward with this, in various interviews, Donald Trump has said, you know, I would do it, but Mattis doesn't want it, and so I'm not going to do it. But it's not very clear. This put CIA Director Mike Pompeo in really difficult straits after he told the Senate in his confirmation hearings that he would, quote, absolutely not, end quote, bring this back, that he was satisfied with the state of the law. Now, he left the door open a little bit more in some written answers to the Senate Intelligence Committee. But this was really awkward, and people close to Pompeo let it be known that he was blindsided by this draft executive order.
I mean, Eliana, this raises the issue, again, of whether what we're seeing is Olivier is saying, well, wait, remember, these are executive orders, and you as well, executive actions, doesn't have the same weight as legislation. When you look at the activity of this first week, Eliana, do you see a drive toward real change in policy, including, I mean, you've got a draft presidential order there on the torture front, or do you see theater sort of just throwing everything up in the air and giving the president more running room? Sometimes a person is tempted to see theater here. Other times you see, whoa, things are really changing right behind the theatrics.
I think these are signals of what President Trump wants the priorities of his presidency to be. And much of what he's going to be able to accomplish is going to depend on the level of cooperation he can get both from his cabinet secretaries and from the Congress on these initiatives. So if his defense secretary and his CIA director are opposed to waterboarding, it's going to be very difficult for him to reinstate that policy. Both of them had said publicly they believe it's against the law. It's going to be very difficult to make certain changes to immigration law without the cooperation of a Republican Congress. I think it's important to remember that the way to think about this government is sort of like a coalition government where you have a populist, nationalist president in the White House that's going to agree with the Republican majority in Congress on some things. He's going to agree with Democrats in Congress on other things. But there isn't a party in Congress that he aligns or sees eye to eye with on everything and is going to be able to ram through lots of legislation with. Same with his cabinet secretaries. They disagree with him on many, many things. And I don't think he nominated cabinet secretaries who are pushovers. These people in their in their confirmation hearings have publicly disagreed with him. So I think Trump personally is signaling what's important to him, but it remains to be seen how much of that he's going to be able to get accomplished.
Jack, I want to bring that question to you as well, but let me go to our listeners first, if I may. Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
To the torture question, there's an old saying, be careful who you choose to be your enemies because you'll become just like them. I want to suggest to Mr. Trump that he slow his roll, slow down. He's a novice. He's a tenderfoot, trying to do everything in 100 days. He should really, first of all, try and find his way around Washington. Now, if we want to see what...
But wait, Tom, maybe that's not what he wants to do. I mean, they've come with a lot of disdain, at least talking for Washington. You heard him in his inaugural address. He said it's almost like, hey, the revolution's here, the people. He doesn't want to slow down.
I mean, he can't do all this. The smart money in the country is the stock market is hitting new highs because they're scared to death of inflation. And all these programs he's throwing forward without being able to pay for them, that's going to trigger inflation, which is a really, really bad, bad thing.
Watch out for that one. Slow down the roll, says Tom in Wisconsin. Thank you, Tom. Trish in Lexington, Kentucky. Trish, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to speak about your immigration question. I voted for Trump.
Okay.
And one of the biggest issues that was almost a deal killer for me when I was in the voting booth was this issue of immigration. And the reason is because I am a farmer in Lexington, Kentucky. I raise horses, and we are a big agricultural community here in Kentucky, especially central Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it is Mexican labor on their backs, and they're dedicated, hardworking people that we have been able to survive. And let me tell you something. In 25 years, I may have interviewed two American men. They do not want these jobs, not even for $10.50 an hour. That is what I pay my Mexican staff.
Hey, but Trish, you voted for Donald Trump, but he couldn't have been more clear about his position on immigration.
That is correct. But the reason why is because I am also very frustrated by the same token with the other side that I'm getting pushed back on. I'm not a one-issue voter. I'm not just on immigration. I'm also pro-life. There are other issues that I have to balance. But I will tell you, when I hear things like this, it does get me upset. I'm like, please, just get yourself together and just, how can you, that's just not the way, that's not the tone that I was hoping that he would come out with.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, as a Trump voter, it's an issue.
Yeah, Trish, we've got it. And that is interesting. Some Trump voters, anyway, they're Trish, watching the pace and watching the direction, the tone of this, things she wants, things she doesn't. Big abortion rally, of course, going on right now in Washington. Let's get one more here. Sarah, Salem, New York. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I am very, very concerned, and frankly, concerned isn't strong enough a word, alarmed. Donald Trump has not changed his tone, and I'm not surprised. He is who he is. Why are we expecting him to behave in a diplomatic or presidential manner? He seems to think he became dictator-in-chief and that what he wants to have happen happens without any regard for the Constitution, without any regard for standing law, and without any regard, frankly, for a lot of people that voted for him. I mean, some of his primary actions that nobody seems to be paying a lot of attention to are going to hurt those white working class people. And I know because I live in a 95% Republican area of upstate New York.
Yeah, Sarah, we've got it. I appreciate your call. I mean, we have yet to see clearly, Jack, how Trump's big base of support is responding to this. I mean, I've seen reports this week signaling that they pretty much like the sort of cut of the jib of these first actions. But what about the tone? The tone for actually getting things done in Washington and how he may or may not bring his supporters along with him, Jack?
Well, he's at a Quinnipiac poll today has him at a 35% approval rating, compared to 59% for Barack Obama at this point in his first year.
I mean, never mind Obama for any president starting out. That's pretty darn low.
That's pretty darn low. So you'd have to say, yes, he's succeeding, but only with his core constituents.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Oscars hashtag not so white anymore, Moonlight, Hidden Figures, Lion, and Fences, the film adaptation of August Wilson's play, all nominated for Academy Award. Here from Fences.
It's not easy for me to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you.
Denzel Washington and Viola Davis there in a rare January tornado outbreak in the southeast. 19 people died in 48 hours. Here's Albany, Georgia resident James Black on the twister that hit his home.
It sounded like a train, and I told everybody to get down in the house. And then a couple of seconds later, we felt the house shake.
Sounded like a train. That's the way they come in. Beloved TV actress Mary Tyler Moore, the spunky star of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, died Wednesday at age 80. Here she is playing her character in the show, Mary Richards.
Would you say that I'm doing as good a job as the guy who was the associate producer before me?
Better.
Oh, much better.
Yeah, he was terrible.
Yeah.
Well, then, how come he was making $50 a week more than I do?
That was the question. Still is sometimes. We're looking at a week news, and it is a week in the news, and it is week one of the Trump presidency. Eliana Johnson is with us from Politico. Olivier Knox from Yahoo News. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What do you make of this first week of President Trump? Is he pointing us toward big breakthroughs here or big problems? What do you think of President Donald Trump's start in the Oval Office? Theresa May, Prime Minister of the UK, she who's now trying to work out all the Brexit stuff, is in the country visiting Donald Trump. The Mexican president will not come. That canceled. Word just out in the last 24 hours that the President Trump will talk with Vladimir Putin on Saturday, I guess. A lot of conversation about who initiated that. Early this morning, Kellyanne Conway told Gail King on CBS This Morning it doesn't matter who initiated the planned call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin tomorrow.
Who initiated the call, Kellyanne?
I won't divulge that, but it also doesn't matter in that we have to have leaders talking to each other. We have to forge better relationships around the globe.
Better relationships around the globe, but the first call, or not the first, but one of the very early ones going here right to Moscow. Eliana Johnson, we've got no to Mexico. Yes, Theresa May is here. Vladimir Putin called tomorrow. Benjamin Netanyahu coming as an early visitor. What's emerging? Can we say much yet about the Trump sort of foreign policy priority, foreign capital priority array as you look out on those announced and upcoming visits and talks?
Yeah, I think if you look at Trump's inaugural address, it was really the most inward-looking inaugural address in the post-World War II era. And in the sense that it talked about America's role on the world stage, it talked about other countries taking advantage of the U.S. And really, I think Trump is the first post-World War II president to feel a hostility to America's global leadership role. So when you're looking at the way he's interacting with these countries, I think it's a little early to say, but I do think it's worth looking at Trump's outreach to Russia and other great powers with respect. I think it's possible that he sees a chance that other powers could take America's global leadership role. He's talked about Russia, working with Russia to combat ISA, ISIS, excuse me, mm-hmm. and that he doesn't think that would be a bad thing. I think the argument you're going to hear from other Republicans and Democrats, there's really been a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy, is that when the U.S. retreats from its global leadership role, other countries like Russia, like Iran, like China fill the vacuum, and that's not a good thing. I'm not sure Trump thinks it's a bad thing, and that's where I see real clashes coming between Trump and Republican and Democratic lawmakers this administration.
You were Washington editor for the National Review, quite conservative. You know that whole school of thought. Is it amazing to you that a Republican president would have the Russian president so high on his call list, Vladimir Putin coming right in there tomorrow?
I don't think it's quite right to think of Trump as a Republican president. I realize he has an R by his name.
I mean,
he
won the presidency running as the Republican.
Yes, but that's true. But I think if you're thinking of him in a conventional Republican framework, I think you're not going to understand what's going on here. I think the ideology undergirding the Trump White House is a real departure from anything we've ever seen. And so I think in terms of helping people understand what's happening, it's wrong to think of him in a conventional framework. There has been it's not Republican or Democrat, but a bipartisan consensus about America's role on the world stage, helping to stabilize global affairs.
And Trump may not care, you're saying.
I would point out, George W. Bush talked about ending tyranny in the world, very controversial. Barack Obama talked about America's role as a peacemaker around the world.
Well, every president since World War II, at least.
Okay,
right?
I don't think Donald Trump fits in to or has a conception of America's role on the world stage. And to the extent he does, he thinks the post-World War II international order has not served middle-class voters in America, middle-class citizens in America, or the lower middle class. He thinks that they've been taken advantage of by this, and that if Russia wants to take a global leadership role, so much the better.
Quick call. I'll come to you, Jack. Matthew in Bangor, Maine. Matthew, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say how thankful I am. I voted for Trump in the general, but I also supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. And the last week, seeing some traditional diplomatic relations that maybe had cooled under Obama are now, coming back to the forefront.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. I mean, Mexico has just got blown up, our relations there.
With the United Kingdom, with France, with Russia, with Israel, the United Kingdom, our relations with them had cooled in the last 8 years. Now Theresa May is here.
Well, I don't know about the last 8 years. Over Brexit, certainly. President Obama was not so keen on Brexit, no question about that, and plenty of tension with Israel there, no question about that. France, I don't know if this is a big problem. On the other hand, Donald Trump may be encouraged to see right-wing populists rising there. What's the profile that you're preferring here, Matthew, in terms of American allies? Are you preferring America to be closer to Putin?
Yes, of course, because diplomacy with Russia will make sure we don't go to war with Russia. Having good relationship with Russia is not a bad thing. They're one of our allies in the war against ISIS, bringing stability to Syria. How are these things bad? The other thing, I don't mean to correct one of your panelists.
Okay.
But President Trump, his favorability rating just went up to 59%. That's gone up between 7 and 9% just since his speech.
I don't know. I have to fact check that, and we will. That I don't think that's the number that we're seeing or we're citing. But, Matthew, I take your perspective on international relations. Jack Beatty, tie it back to ideology, whether looking outward, foreign policy, or inward. I mean, Eliana knows this world very well and Republicans very well, and you hear she says it's not exactly Republican. It's almost as though we have three political forces at work in Washington right now. There's been a lot of talk about Steve Bannon, the biggest strategist for Donald Trump, we're told, this week. How do you see the ideological profile that's emerging here, Jack?
Well, I think there's evidence that Mr. Trump is pulling the Republican Party in his direction, that he's making it a Trump party. David Brooks in today's New York Times has data showing how dramatically Republicans have changed on the issue of trade. I mean, just a year ago, they were trade is good for the United States, globalization is good. Now, diametrically opposed, they're with Trump. On Russia, people have pointed this out. A year ago, what Republicans thought about Putin and Russia, very, very bad. Since then, now not a majority, but a great many more Republicans have moved in Trump's direction. So I'm not really sure that we can make such a... And notice how capitulant the Republican Party has been to him. I mean, Paul Ryan is basically just sort of holding on and saying, okay, cut taxes on rich people, deregulate, get rid of Obamacare, and we'll go along with all the rest. Mitch McConnell was asked, what about the possibility of a blow-up in relations with Mexico? Oh, the president can take care of that. They're not opposing him. They're sort of witting allies in making over the Republican Party.
Steve Bannon, what do you see in terms of ideology here? And what about Steve Bannon's role? There's been a lot written about Steve Bannon this week. And, of course, he came out saying that the press should just keep its mouth shut as the new president takes office and begins his way. I don't know how that figures into the idea of a free press acting as a watchdog in this country. But what about ideology, how it sits vis-a-vis what's been in Washington? And what about Steve Bannon, Olivier?
Well, remind me where he said that the press should shut up.
To the New York Times this morning.
Oh, that's weird. The New York Times. That's curious. Huh. And then they freeze the Washington Post out of his rallies, but then they phone up Washington Post reporters.
You're too cute by half, Olivia, for me. I'm not sure what you mean. Could you be very plain?
I mean that it's that they have a very complicated relationship with the press, and that the idea that it all boils down to hating us and wanting to cut us out is ridiculous. They actually are really good at using the press for sure. And I don't think it's a question of being too cute by half. I think it's a question of watching how they are getting their message out and to whom. And in terms of ideology, it's a little bit complicated. I think Ileana is dead on that you absolutely cannot shoehorn Donald Trump into the traditional two-party system and understand what he's doing. I think it is fairly clear to me that they have a couple of different missions. One of them is to shake up the way things are done and have been done in Washington. The flip side of that is the last two presidents we had started their foreign policy with an attempt to reset relations with Russia. Mm-hmm. George W. Bush famously looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul and tried to carve out a more cooperative relationship, especially after the 9/11 attacks. Barack Obama came in literally vowing a reset in relations. It paid brief dividends while Putin was not the president. When Putin came back in as the president, it all fell apart. So that in some ways is a little bit conventional. Your caller says, what's bad about having a good relationship with Russia? Well, that's not the question. The question is on whose terms and what do you give up? What do you give up to get that good relationship? Kellyanne Conway this morning, one, she's absolutely right. It doesn't really matter how the call got set up. These are typically presidential calls are complicated arrangements. They start at relatively low diplomatic levels and they get built up until it reaches the White House. But the more important thing she said was that easing sanctions on Russia over its invasion of Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea might get eased early on in the Trump administration. That's what we should be looking at. It's not the notion of a better relationship. It's on whose terms. And I'll just stop there. Really the most important part of this question about ideology.
Matt in Buffalo, New York. Matt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I heard the call with the other. I'm also a former Bernie Sanders supporter from the Democratic primary who voted for Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
But the previous caller's discussion about foreign policy really has me worried, especially with the importance of Mexico as a trading partner to the United States, and specifically to states like Texas and Wisconsin who export very heavily to Mexico. The idea of starting a trade war with Mexico really concerns me. As well as this pivot toward Russia as a new ally in the fight against, you know, radical Islamist terror, they haven't been doing a whole lot of action when it comes to bombing ISIS in Syria. They've been mostly just attacking moderate rebels. So I think this turn toward Russia is a very misguided move and one that may be, in fact, more nefarious than we think right now.
So how would you rate the week, Matt?
If it's possible to rate it at a zero, I think it's basically at about a zero. Especially with the news that Mick Mulvaney, the nominee for Office of Management and Budget, is more than willing to cut Social Security and Medicare. I think a lot of Trump supporters may realize soon that they kind of got duped.
Matt, I appreciate your call. I want to talk for just a second about Donald Trump and the media. Olivia, I think you're suggesting that it's not a serious sort of breach there, but certainly the language has been... kind of incredible language for a sitting president. This was Saturday, first full day as president. And, of course, everybody heard this, but this was Donald Trump talking with CIA employees at the agency's headquarters in Langley.
The reason you're my first stop is that, as you know, I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth.
What? Okay, applause there. Let's remember, he has taken a kind of a cheerleading pack with him wherever he's gone. So I don't know what the division there, who's laughing, who's applauding. But Eliana, this running war with the media and the question of honesty, alternative facts and truth and lies and falsehood all came up this week in very startling fashion. Where does that leave, should that leave the American public, in, first of all, in terms of trusting the veracity of what comes out of the White House? And what about this war with the media, Eliana?
Yeah, this is one of the things that's been driving me crazy, where the media is tearing a tear out. Why is Trump picking a fight over the size of his inauguration? Why is Trump disputing this, whether he won the popular vote or not? I think it's important to understand, and Olivier alluded to this, this is an intentional strategy. Trump has said the media is the new opposition party, again, to suggest he's not a Republican, he's not a Democrat, he doesn't oppose the Democratic Party because he's a Republican president. It's the media that is now, he now considers the opposition party. Trump thrives when he is demonizing somebody else. There was Little Marco, Lion Ted, Crooked Hillary, and now it's the dishonest, corrupt media.
What about truth from the White House? Is it proving to be trustable?
I think it's very troubling to see Trump's press secretary go out and say something that's clearly a lie when he says that their inauguration crowd size was larger than or the largest in history.
And the president himself?
The president himself, I think we know, has issues with the truth. But my point is, this is an intentional tactic that serves Trump because it fires up his base and it got him to where he is today. It's not people wonder, why is he doing this? Why can't he control himself? No, this is it's intentional and it served him quite well.
Jack Beatty, serves Trump, serve the country?
24 verifiable falsehoods, distortions, lies just in the first week, according to the Washington Post. Press checker, fact checker, and the Financial Times. The spectacle of obvious lies being peddled by the White House is a tragedy for American democracy. So maybe it's a tactic, but it's shaking the pillars of our system.
Well, we'll see where this goes. He has come to shake things up. To our caller in Maine, the latest Quinnipiac poll finds Donald Trump at 36% rating. We'll see where that goes as well. I want to thank all three of you for being with us at the end of this first week. Olivier Knox at Yahoo News, chief Washington correspondent there. Great to have you, Olivier. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eliana Johnson, national political reporter for Politico. Thank you, Eliana.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, here we go. Here we are. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.